Okay, he said, get up, gird yourself, put your cloak on, and tie your sandals on your feet. I thought that was, we just talked about that. It just kind of brings that whole element together there. Was there another one? All right, Peter goes to, it'd be John Mark's mother's house, and he's knocking at the gate. It's not the house door, he's knocking at the gate. What's that tell us about John Mark's mother? She's probably a fairly wealthy person. And then what happens? Who comes to the door, comes and answers? Okay, it's a servant girl, Rhoda, which means rose. So I got a nickname for my granddaughter now, Rhoda. So it's a fairly good chance that Rhoda was a Gentile slave girl. Where was she before she came to the gate? Doing what? Okay, she was up there attending the prayer meeting. So we have possibly, I can't be dogmatic about it, but possibly a Gentile slave girl in prayer meeting with Jewish believers and would have known Peter well enough to have recognized his voice. And so I just thought that added quite a bit because, okay, they're probably in the upper room and she would have come down through the courtyard to the gate in order to answer. Turn around, run all the way back up there and give her news, and then everybody comes down to see Peter. So I thought that was neat to see those things tie together as we just looking at them. Tonight we're going to look at the light, and that's not the right. We've talked about there's so many differences between the poor and the wealthy, and lighting would have been one of those differences. And I have a couple of different lamps there. The first being very simple, right? It's just a bowl with the end, and they would have taken a piece of cloth or a piece of flax and that pinch point, and it would have soaked up olive oil, and they would have lit it, and that would have been the light for the house. They wouldn't have had a lampstand or anything special. Of course, that's very rudimentary. If you're moving around the house, what could happen? You could knock it over and have a fire. You knock it over and spill the oil would probably be more of the, because the oil would have been the most valuable part of it. Spill the oil, that's costly. So very fixed to that was to just bring the sides of the bowl up around the top. You have two holes, one in the top to pour your oil in and one out at the point to stick your wick. You kind of help solve that problem. Then you put a little handle on it so you can carry it around instead of having to hold it in your hand. So I need a little bit of help tonight. We're going to try a little thing for the kids. I need some volunteers. Let's see, three or four kids come up and help. Fire is involved. All right, Evan. Somebody, a sculptor. Play with Play-Doh. Abram, you want to come up? Grace? I just want to see if those archaeologists know what they're talking about. Can we actually make a lamp that would work with the ingredient they gave us? All right, can you make something that looks like that top picture? Where's my wick? My wick fell off. I had it on there when I... It must have fallen off when I walked over. All right, we got a nice little bowl. Hey, if we put oil in there, what's going to happen? You think it'll sink through? I see some cracks. Let's fix up those cracks a little bit. You take a little piece of Kleenex and roll it up kind of like... All right, good job. Now, we got a bowl, but we need a place to set our wick. How can we do that? You don't know? How about we just tick our finger and do something like that? Pinch it up there like that. Does your wick fit in that little spot? Okay, looks like it will. Now, Liberty, you want to take hold of that and come over here. We can put olive oil in here because that's what they would have used was olive oil. Soaks up that oil. See if Evan can get that to light. All right, it's lit. It's lit. Turn off the lights for us and see how much light this produces. Yep, step off to the side so we can get that. That's not a lot of light, is it? You go home tonight, you're going to want more light than that, aren't you? But if you remember, they don't have a table. Now, we have a problem. When all the light's down there, it's kind of hard to see. So what would you do? You don't have a table. A really poor person probably wouldn't have any shelves. But they might have a basket or a bucket or something that they would use to do other work with. And so at night, they're not using their bucket. So they'd come and they'd put their bucket over top of that, right, like that. Is that what they would do? Did they hide their lamp under the bushel basket? No. They would turn their basket over and they would put the light up on top of the basket. So when we sing "This Little Light of Mine," what do we say? Hide it under a bushel? No, we don't hide it under the bushel. We set it on top of the bushel, right? Thank you. You guys can go sit down. It smoked a little bit there at the beginning, but it wasn't doing too bad. Now look at it. I should have had one of the kids blow it out. All right. So, poverty, they wouldn't have had furniture. Only the really rich would have had a table. Some of the more well-to-do would have a lampstand or something that they might have multiple lamps set on, and they would light them and fill them with oil. Let's look at Matthew 5 and verse. So Jesus is using an illustration that would have been understood by what class of people? The poorest people. Interesting is in the study we're seeing how Jesus related with some of the richest people, where he probably got his clothes from, and some of the poorest people by the examples that he chose. Matthew 25 and verse 8. Okay, another parable that Jesus is telling. A marriage feast is taking place. They're waiting for the groom to bring the bride back, and they would entertain him when he comes with their lit lamps. But some of the foolish virgins didn't bring any oil, and the groom tarried. And with these small little lamps, you got to keep pouring oil into them in order to keep them burning. You have to fill them up every day. And they weren't ready. They didn't have enough oil, and their lamps went out. And those that were wise had the lamp as well as the oil. Matthew 12 and verse 20, okay, he's quoting Isaiah 42:3 there. And this one helped me, because when I read those verses before, the first part of the picture, the bruised reed, well, that's a plant that's out in the wilderness, something that is outdoors and growing. Flax is also a plant that is out there. And so in my mind's eye was some kind of a wildfire has come through and brought destruction of some kind, and he won't snuff out the last bit of life. But the picture here is the lamp. The flax was used as the wick. And when the oil burnt down and the flax ran out of oil, it would start to smoke, just like when I blew that out. It just sat there with a little ember and started to smoke. So what is he saying there? He's not going to snuff out the lamp, but what will he do? What do you do with the lamp? If you're not going to put it out, are you just going to leave it to smoke? You're going to add more fuel to it, right? Add more oil so that it will catch fire again and start burning. So that's kind of the illustration there. He's not just going to come and snuff out the weak, but he's going to bring new life to them. I don't know how accurate some of my information is, but he said that they allowed the light to burn all night. I wish he'd give some citing of his resources, but we have night lights sometimes. We live in a city, you're not living in utter darkness. There's street lights and things. But you go out into the wilderness, and before there is electricity, it's pretty dark at night. And so this makes sense that you would leave some kind of a light. It brings comfort. If you happen to wake up in the middle of the night, you can see what's going on. And it doesn't put off a terrible lot of light that you could. The thought here is that to put somebody out at night without a light was a very severe thing to do. It spoke of a real broken relationship. You would never, especially in a culture where hospitality is held at an extreme level, and we'll see this as we look at some other things, but you have entertained somebody, or you have a family member or a servant or something, and you send them out of the house without light, you're casting them out. you don't want them back. You've broken relationship with them. So let's look at Job 8, verse 6. Okay. The light is dark, and it speaks to the fact that they may have allowed that light to burn through the night. And if it's not being tended, something's wrong. Or they're so poor, and such destruction has happened to them that they don't have the oil to keep the light burning all night. Matthew 8, verses 10 through 12. Okay, so we have this contrast, this relationship, this fellowship that Gentiles are going to come and sit with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. But then there's also those that are shut out in utter darkness. We see it again in 22 and verse 13 and 25 and verse 30. In one case, the illustration of Israel being a son of the kingdom, they should have had the right to come in, but they have broken fellowship with God and are cast out of the kingdom. Here, Israel is a servant, and the servant is cast out. There's broken fellowship. There's broken relationship. Fire, kind of like light. It provides some light, but it's also used for a lot of other things. And I love to have a fireplace. I grew up with a fireplace. And in the wintertime, we'd stoke up the fire and sit around it and just soak in the warmth and watch the flames and everything. Love to have a fire. We had a chimney, and a couple times we caught the chimney on fire. That was kind of exciting. You probably wouldn't appreciate a fire the same way. If people of poverty level would have had a fire in their home, it would have been just on the dirt floor, maybe like as if you were camping. You might make a little depression, maybe put some stones around it or something, keep kids out of it. But they didn't have a chimney. And so the smoke would just rise up, go to the ceiling, and work its way out of the house. Some of them would have maybe put a little vent of some kind up there. But for the most part, the smoke filled the house. Not very good, pleasant way of living. In fact, they figured that we've extended our life expectancy in part because we stopped burning wood. And we don't breathe in all those fumes and smoke. And so it may have even shortened their life, but they didn't just burn wood. They made their fires out of animal poop. Yuck. How would you like to cook dinner over that? I saw a picture, they still do it today, where the ladies would collect the manure and pack it in bowls or whatever and pack it in really tight, flip them over, and allow the sun to dry them out. And then they would be able to sell that for fuel or use it for fuel. And so they take that dried animal dung and burn it in their house. That's not very good. How gross. Cook over it, light your house with it. There are only twice in Scripture that a charcoal fire or a wood fire, and that was when Peter was when Jesus was being put on trial, about to be crucified, and Peter was warming himself by the fire. And then later, after Jesus rose again, and he met his disciples on the beach when they were fishing, and he had them bring fish for breakfast, and he roasted that fish over a charcoal fire. I'm sure that they would have burned wood, sticks, grass, whatever they could find, but parts of Israel were fairly barren, and so they wouldn't have had a lot of good fuel. Other parts of Israel had plenty of trees. In fact, we often think of Israel as pretty much desert, but that really didn't happen until all these years and years of war and Rome coming in and utterly destroying Israel and turning it into a barren wasteland. Property. As we think of things, we like to own things. And even today, we're kind of moving away from an ownership society. They want us to rent everything and not have ownership. But when you have these Bedouin communities, they were living kind of like the Native Americans. They would move so often. They didn't think in terms of owning land. But when God calls Abraham into Israel, his promise is the land. And from that time, the perspective is changing. And this is, I heard one person talking about it as causing problems in 1940s when they put Israel back into the land and signing treaties and things. The Palestinians think of a homeland as a place where you entertain your guests. The Israelites think of a homeland the way we would think of owning property. And so they were kind of talking past one another and didn't understand what was taking place. And they think that caused some problems. It's part of the misunderstanding against Israel. We know that that goes back further. But it is interesting that God gives ownership. He wants them to own the land and to have stewardship of that land. Let's look at Jeremiah 32, 10 through 14. Got some names. So Jeremiah is in jail. He's told to buy this property. His relative is going to come and try to sell him property because he's in distress. And you don't just give it to anybody. You want to sell it within the family if you can. Keep that property in the family. And that was God's design. And so God tells him, go ahead and buy it. And Jeremiah's like, we've been prophesying. Everything's going to be destroyed. We're going to be carried off into Babylon. What's the point of owning land? Go ahead and buy the land. Put the deed in a jar and seal it up so that it will survive many days. And then he probably buried it. Later you see him burying something when he gets carried down into and makes a prophecy and kind of does the same thing and buries something in the ground. But the idea was that, yes, destruction's coming, God's taking them out of the land, but the promise is God's going to bring them back to the land and give them that ownership back. Whatever was on the land or in the land or under the land was theirs. I kind of disappointed when I found out that when you buy property here that you don't own the rights to everything. Somebody else owns the mining rights, or they own the oil rights. You might own the ground, but you don't have the right to like open up a mine. Well, that's not the case in Israel. If you owned the land, you owned everything on it and everything found on it. So Matthew 25, 18. Okay, so this is a parable of the talents, and the servant receives it, and he buries it in the ground. That's their way of having a bank. That's the safest thing. You know where it's at. Nobody else knows where it's at. If they're out there digging, you know they're looking, and you can drive them away. If there was a threat of an army coming through, they would take their possessions, what few that they would have, and they might go out and bury it in the ground in their field and hide it. And the army would come through, maybe destroy the house, fences or whatever, but they wouldn't get their hands on your most valuable possessions because they couldn't find them. And this has created, over the years, treasure hunters. And they would go back into Israel and Middle Eastern places, would start with their metal detectors and things and try to find treasures. And it was even common up into the Middle Ages and up into Europe. They'd stow away pots of cash in the ground, and they still find them today. Matthew 13:44. We got a trespasser. Or maybe it's a piece of land nobody's been taking care of, and he's just out for a stroll, and he stumbles over something, and he uncovers it, and oh, look, there's a treasure here. It's not your treasure. It belongs to somebody else. So he quick covers it back up, and he goes and finds the owner, who doesn't know that there's a treasure there, and he makes a price, buys the land, and then that treasure became his. Because he's the owner of the land, he owns everything hidden on it. Land boundaries were very simple, and even today we have problems with land dispute, but God had given them laws to try to establish those boundary markers. They would have drawn lots when Joshua was dividing up the land, and they would measure it out with a cord or a line, and then they would put a stone, and that would be your boundary marker. And then as years go by, they might run a trench. They would take their plow and plow the dirt one way for one farmer and plow the dirt the other way for the other farmer, and it would leave a low spot. Or maybe they would find stones in their property, and they would put them between the land boundary. And so it's not disturbing your neighbor, it's not disturbing. A lot of times, those furrows, that land boundary, became a walking path that they could get from place to place, but the farmers would farm right up to it, just kind of like we're doing today, taking fences out and farming the ditches. They'd farm right up to that boundary path. Psalm 16:6. Hey, they measured out the property with lines, and that's what he's referring to. Proverbs 22:28. Okay, now there's different kinds of landmarks, but it's probably in reference to the property boundary landmark. That it's also codified in the law, it's in Deuteronomy, that they're not to move the boundary markers. Proverbs 23:10. Then Mark 2, why would the disciples be walking through somebody's crop? So one day I was in a fence for a fella, and I had to go on to the neighbor's side of the fence in order to put the, there was a ditch and everything. Well, I got done with my work, and I was coming out of the field. Here comes the owner, and he was hot. Chewed me up one side and down the other. He did not want me in on his property. And so we have these property problems. Why would you be walking through somebody else's field? Well, they weren't. They were walking the boundary path. And the crop is growing right up to the boundary path. They're just able to put their hand out and take the heads of grain. And it was allowable to do that. The poor are allowed to glean the corners of the field. Water is absolutely necessary for life. In most cases, water had to be brought from a well. Wells were dug where water was easiest to find. And so in the spring, there's all kinds of rain and stuff, or in the wet season, and you would be able to collect it out of pools. But in the heat of the dry season, the surface water disappeared. But you knew where that water could be. You'd go to those dried up stream beds, and you might sink down a hole 3-4 feet deep, and it would fill up with water because groundwater there. And so that's what they'd make a well wherever they needed it. They needed to water their livestock. They would probably just go to something like that and dig a hole there to water. But you also want water where it's most convenient. And so you'd want water at the center of a village. And that would have been much harder. You have to dig deeper to find that groundwater. Some of these wells were kind of like we picture a well, kind of a circular thing with the bucket that goes down in them, but not all of them were that way. Some of them, actually, you could walk down into. You can kind of see in my pictures there, the top is Beersheba, which is Abraham's well. He very likely dug it. It may not have looked like it does right there in that picture, but it's been there for thousands of years. And this other down in the bottom there, you can see steps going down into the well. They would have had to carry water up all those steps and then carry it to their house. Well-to-do households had cisterns which captured water off the roof. This would run out in the dry season. Now, what's the problem with capturing water off of a roof? Contaminated. You ever see birds on top of your roof? What do you think they're doing up there? But even worse than that, remember, their roofs were part of their living space. And so they were walking up there, they were doing things up there, you know, all kinds of contamination. And all that would come off and down into their cistern, and then they would have that water to use. Well, a lot of times water was contaminated, and so they had to mix with wine. And the alcohol content in the wine would kill the critters that were in their water. They didn't have to mix it so heavy that they would get drunk on it, but just enough alcohol content to kill the critters in the water. We'll probably come back and talk about wine a little bit later. The bottom left picture is a cistern in Jerusalem. And you can make it out. There's a person standing in the bottom of that cistern. This is just huge. Now, most of the land around there is sandstone, and so it's easy to dig out. And a person would dig out a cistern for himself, and he would have to go in and plaster that cistern. But it's a land that has a lot of earthquakes, and what happens when the earth moves? It cracks your cistern. And your cistern's full of water. What's going to happen to all that water? You go to the cistern hoping to get water, you put your bucket in there, and there's nothing there. The water all seeped out because of a crack. So let's look at some of these verses here. 2 Kings 31, right? A chicken in every pot, a Ford in every garage, right? He's making promises of wealth. You have your own vine, you have your own cistern. These are wealthier individuals. And so everybody's going to get a cistern if you just don't listen to Hezekiah. 2 Samuel 17, 17 through 19. Okay, this is probably a cistern that was in the dry season. If not, it was a very wet hiding place. But as it gets to the end, you've used up all that water. And so they were able to hide in carrying on their spying activity. Nehemiah 9, 25. Okay, he's recalling what God had done for Israel in bringing them into this land and giving them cisterns that they didn't have to dig. That's very hard work to have a good cistern. You had to have been doing pretty well. Jeremiah 2. Okay, so we have a developing picture in that verse. The first thing was wells of living water, wells of moving water. And if you remember back, Isaac dug wells, and one of the last wells that he dug was a well that had moving water. He tapped into an underground stream. And that's the best water. It's the freshest. It's just constantly being refreshed, filtered through all that sand, and it's really good water. Well, not everybody has that, so they dig a cistern and they catch the rainwater. That's good water, but it's not as good. And so he's given us this picture of deterioration from good living water to stale, stagnant water to no water at all because your cistern broke. I was kind of surprised, put a liner in the old septic tank and filled it up with water and kind of experiment. And I went over there to top it off with the rainwater, and it had gone stagnant. And that new water that was going in there had all kinds of gases and stuff coming out of there. Oh, I can't imagine drinking water out of a stagnant cistern. But, of course, their cistern's bigger probably. And they had laws about it. It was too small, it was considered contaminated, but if it was large enough and had much water, it wasn't considered. Jeremiah 38, we have these great big chemical totes that we're catching rainwater in off of the garage, and then I was transferring it into, well, I got that all drained out of the tank, and in just one summer, the whole bottom of that tank was muck. Stuff that had come off the roof, leaves that had fallen in and rotted and settled to the bottom. We had some fish in there to keep mosquitoes out. Muck. And that's what he's talking about. The end of the year, the cistern's empty, could use it as a dungeon. You drop somebody in by a rope, there's no way they're getting it. And so at the bottom, it was all mucky and sank down into it. It was not a pleasant. Well, there, we'll stop there. We got a little bit more about water, but we're out of time. Brian, can I get...